From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, during the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Brian McInerney, the hydrologist with the National Weather Service, and he's here to give us our seasonal update. We have him in four times a year. We'll be talking about the status of water storage, how the spring melt went, what summer temps and precip are looking like so far. We'll kind of do the overall profile of the season. And then we're also going to touch on flash flooding, on some recent floods and
also some tragedy there.
Yeah, how we can make sure to avoid that.
Why'd that happen? Because it happens. It happens more than we care to to wish it happened. People get caught by surprise quickly. Mm-hmm. And Brian has talked about in the past, and we'll talk about it again now. And of course, he'll give us his famous 5-year forecast.
As Brian scoffs in the background. Right.
Okay. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking with Michelle DeHaan and Clint McAfee. They're both with Park City Municipal's Water Department, and they're going to be talking about the 2017 annual Water Quality Consumer Confidence Report that was mailed to all Park City residents a couple weeks ago. It's filled with lots of information and cool stuff, including the results of their water quality testing. So we'll go over that with Michelle and Clint. The good news there, we'll also learn why we don't have lead in our water. That's good, too. We don't
good
have lead in our water
around.
And why we don't have lead. And, of course, the most important question for them is to explain what in the world swabbing and ice pigging is all about. It's right here in paragraph number 5 of the report.
You won't want to miss this.
You do not want to miss. Learn about that.
Well, remember, we don't take phone calls live during the show, but you can join in by messaging us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
We'll be right back.
Steve here from Kumbaya Kitchens and Rhode Island Diner, longtime listener and supporter of KPCW. Since 1997, we've been providing catering service to the Park City community for formal and non-formal events. At the Rhode Island Diner in Oakley, we are now open Wednesday through Sunday. KumbayaKitchens.com or eat@RhodeIslandDiner.com.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And, of course, in the studio with us is the one and only Brian McInerney, hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invite.
You're late, Brian. Usually you come here the summer solstice and equinox and all that.
Yeah.
But due to scheduling issues, I guess you're busy.
Yeah.
Lots of weather going on.
Yeah, pretty busy this year with all the runoff. And then we had transition to flash flooding pretty quick.
All right. Well, we'll get to the flash flooding in a little bit, but let's start with the first part of that sentence, the runoff.
Yeah.
When you were here last in March or so, we had, 4, 5, 6 feet of snow? We had healthy, healthy amounts of snow, and the thought was that we could be facing an excessive runoff, excessive snow melt, and then, of course, the risks of flooding here or there. How did that all unfold?
So when you look at the volume of water that came out of the mountains due to spring snowmelt runoff, we did really well. It was well above average. We filled all the reservoirs with the exception of Strawberry and maybe a little bit less on Starvation. Everything else filled, and that was wonderful. They even had to pass all sorts of water through many of the reservoirs because of the volume that was expected. And then what we looked at late February and into March was the possibility of some widespread flooding. And what happened was we had 4 peaks during the runoff, which is really rare. You usually get 1 big peak in the spring, late spring. But what happened was it warmed up so significantly in February that we melted off a good chunk of the snow in the valleys and at the lower elevations and flooded a good portion of Cache Valley and Box Elder County. And then we had 3 other peaks due to the warming. So when the final peak did occur, we just touched flood stage at the Logan River in the Cache Valley, and really we didn't have any other issues, which was fortuitous for a lot of reasons. But we did have 7 deaths, which was really unfortunate because of the volume and the rivers were so high that we had little kids fall into the river. We had people jumping in after them, and they died. Mm. And the water is so cold and so swift, you're going to get hypothermia. You have that response where you automatically take a breath because it's so cold that if your head's underwater, you're breathing water, and they think that's what happened to some of these people. Others just couldn't get out. The water was so forceful. So we had 7 fatalities, and that was really unfortunate. And it was really an eventful year. It was something that was unexpected with the warming, but really we're going to see more of this premature melting of the snowpack. And if we would have had a small to below average snowpack moving into this and we had these premature melt scenarios, it would have been really hard for our water supply. We would have lost a great deal of this to evaporation and just going away. It was nice that we had a really big snowpack and that we melted prematurely, yet we had a really large mid and high elevation snow that filled our reservoirs, and that was wonderful. We'll take that.
All right. So say again, we had 4 melts.
4 peaks.
4 peaks of melting?
Yeah. So when you look at the rivers, usually they stay low.
Is that unusual?
Yeah, really unusual. Maybe you'll get 1, maybe you'll get 2 from a premature melt, meaning it warms up sometime in April, and you'll see the bump in the rivers. And then it'll go down, and then we'll see the real melt in earnest in late May and early June. What we saw was melt scenarios that occurred in February, March, April, and in May. Huh. In early June was a small one. So this early melt scenario was something our models had a hard time getting its head around because you don't see this very often. Climatologically, this doesn't happen. And it's due to the warming that we're seeing now in the spring that we haven't seen before. Things are warming up earlier and much more of a magnitude of heat that is promoting this early melt. And when you look at the peak flows, it helps the flood scenarios because you're wringing out a sponge 4 times as opposed to a sponge that's saturated, waiting through till early June and then squeezing it all at once. And all that water goes all over the floor. What we did is we squeezed it a little bit 4 times. The amount of water was still roughly the same, but it came in different timings. And that's really what saved us with a lot of damage flooding. But it still filled the reservoirs, so we'll take that.
So it worked well for us this year.
Yeah.
Early melt scenarios with years where we don't have a huge snowpack.
That's bad.
It's bad.
Yeah. You lose up to over 50% of your snow water equivalent, the water in the snowpack. When you melt prematurely in March, you can lose up to 50% of that to the atmosphere. So when you think you're going to have 100% snowpack, 100% runoff, and you melt early, you have 100% snowpack, and you only have 50% runoff because it just goes into the atmosphere. The plants come back early. They transpire it out through their leaves. It evaporates. If you get a windy period, you lose a lot to sublimation. It just goes away.
That sublimation. I know, rule of thumb, what percentage of our snow, let's say per foot basis or so, sublimates versus melts and turns into water? Sublimating meaning it goes from a solid directly to a gas?
Yeah.
So is there a typical rule of thumb that on average X amount of our snow will sublimate versus melt and into water?
I think on an average year, if you looked at before we started doing warming prematurely, climate change, it was very small. You would lose some just because you get wind transported, that interface between snow and air.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're warming earlier, we get a lot more of this as time commences. Hmm. And it's something you don't want to see in it. And it's a little worrisome that we're melting earlier, that when we do have a snow year that's low, say maybe 70-80%, that we do have a good shot of putting a good portion of that into the reservoirs. When you have these weather conditions with warm, windy days, you have a lot more sublimation as opposed to cold, stormy, cloudy, winter conditions. Yep. We're transitioning to earlier melt, and what that portends for is lower volume of water going into our reservoirs over time.
Okay.
Okay, good. So with that in mind, let's talk about what our weather has looked like this spring and early summer. You know, recently it's been pretty warm, but how have the temps compared to average?
Let's see, April and March and April were actually pretty close to normal. And then as we progressed through the spring, they started getting warmer and warmer until we hit June was about 4.5 degrees above average. And then July so far has been about 10 degrees above average. And this data comes from the ladies at the Park City Library who volunteered to put in a climate station. And they take the weather every day. They take, or the climate, they take the high and the low, and they measure the precip, they measure the snow. And these are librarians, and they did this out of the goodness of their heart. They don't get paid for it. So Park City has a climate station. So if you go to the library, let the ladies know that you appreciate what they're doing for the community, because now we have a record here where we didn't in the past. And what they recorded was really hot in July, up to 10 degrees above. And when we looked at May and June, it progressively got hotter and hotter and drier and drier.
That's up here in Park City. Typically, in the past, before we had that weather station, we were taking data from weather stations around the area that might have been different elevations or down in Salt Lake City, and then kind of making a link to up here.
Yeah.
But now we have weather, and you say 10 degrees above average for the month of July so far.
Yeah.
Right?
Roughly.
So far. What is that compared to the other July since the weather station went into play?
So
it's not a huge history of weather data for that station.
Right. Well, the problem is we've had a climate station, meaning long-term record. We've had it for quite some time, but it's moved around. It was at the fire station. It was at the MARSAC. It was in a guy's backyard for a while. But when you move it too far away or much lower or higher, then it starts a new station because it's a new climate. You can't have the same record for a station that's much lower than where we are. But when you look at the library, that's roughly not too far from the MARSAC or the fire station. So we kind of threaded that record together, and it matched. But there was a period where I think it was in a guy's backyard, and we didn't have any data. Nobody would do it. So we lost the record for that period, which is critical as we continue to warm our atmosphere. And also when you look at this globally, might want to talk about that.
Yeah.
April was the second hottest when you look at the air and the sea surface temperatures. The ocean and the air was the second hottest April we've ever seen. The hottest was 2016.
I think the hotter before that was 2015 or so.
Yeah.
So.
When you look at May, was the second warmest on record, with 2016 as the hottest. And this goes back for 137 years of data.
Yeah.
Wow.
And roughly it's all been in the 2000s that we've set all these records. The last 10 records have all been in the 2000s.
Wow.
So when you look at June, that was the fourth warmest. But the 10 warmest Junes occurred between 2005 and 2017. So we continually get warmer all the time. This is just a trend where we're headed.
So wait a minute. So the 10 warmest Junes have occurred within the last 12 or 13 years?
Yeah. From 2005 to 2017, with the exception of 1998.
Okay.
So that's and that encompasses the oceans and the atmosphere globally. That just shows how hot it's getting. And the worry is that it takes a lot longer for water to warm than air. It's just the properties of water and air, but the oceans are slowly picking up the pace.
And they take a longer time to cool, too.
Yeah.
The oceans hold
think
that,
of it as a
that
sink.
Heat a
that
lot.
Heat goes into the ocean, and it takes a while, but we're getting there now. We're starting to see the combination of the two, which is a good way to measure it because it gives you the whole big picture of what's going on.
Brian McInerney is senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. He's here to talk about, so far, like you said, all things weather and climate and watersheds and hydrology, et cetera. I have a little data. I've been doing a little, I've been tracking our averages per decade temperatures and also 30-year norms. We always talk about what 30-year norm is. And right now the normal temperature that we use over a 30-year period is that total between 1980 and 2010, right? That's the 30-year period that you're looking at.
Yeah, 81. 81 to 2010.
All right, thank you. You're right. And soon, in another 3 years or so, you guys are going to calculate a new normal.
Yeah.
From 1991 to 2020.
Right. The meteorological standard shifts every 10 years.
Well, I've kind of calculated I've kind of looked ahead what the new normal might be. You know, since we're 27 years into, we only have three more years till we get the new normal. The new normal might be somewhere plus or minus 53.6 degrees. The existing normal is around 52.9 degrees. So it's a possibility that the new normal might be 0.7 of a degree or so, plus or minus, warmer than the old normal. And that's what you're going to be using to compare year over year averages.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
But my problem is, here's my problem, Brian.
always a problem. Yeah.
Well, my problem is that we're going to be comparing warmer annual temperatures to a warmer normal.
Yeah.
When reality, maybe we should be comparing our warmer temperatures to like older, more standard normals back in the 60s through 90s or 50s through 80s or 70s through 2000s. Because as the normal goes up, the difference between the two kind of maybe remains the same. And so it just doesn't resonate enough.
Right.
You get where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah, I even gave a talk at a conference showing 1971, 1961, the 30-year average starting in those years. And we're getting progressively warmer and drier on a regular basis. Every 10-year shift is warmer and drier.
So I calculated the 30-year normal between 1951 and 1980 as around 51.6 degrees, let's say, right? Yeah. That's my cap based on weather station down in Salt Lake City. And now we're approaching 53 degrees. So we're seeing 2-degree increase or so in the 30-year normals. That's halfway at least to that 4-degree Fahrenheit tipping point everybody likes to refer to.
Yeah.
So, but that's what we're seeing here in Salt Lake City. Is there any season, one season that seems to be driving this increase more than another, or summers warming at a faster rate than winters or springs or falls, or is it all
daytime,
uniform?
Nighttime?
Yeah. Is it all uniform?
Yeah. If you look at the signal, the nighttime lows are driving that average temperature higher because we don't get as cold at night as we used to. And when you look at the record, you look at daytime highs, it's increasing, but there's more noise in the data. When you look at nighttime lows, the signal is very apparent. We're going up pretty quick. It's not getting as cold at night than it used to. And when you think of why we're warming, the CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide in the atmosphere is retaining the heat that typically radiates back into space at nighttime hours and re-radiates it back into the atmosphere. And that shows in the climate record for nighttime lows. That's what's going on.
Right. I think that's when, you know, a lot of people notice it just anecdotally when you hear people talk about like the temps. It's not so much about the daytime temps. It's about like, oh, I remember at night we used to be at the Deer Valley concerts in our down jackets and our mittens. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. It's focused on those nighttime temps.
Yeah, that's where you see it in the data.
And one consequence of that is what we talked about last week about Utah Lake.
Mm.
That Utah Lake is undergoing its annual incredible algal bloom, and one of the
off to an early start.
Off
with
to an
that
earlier start, and even more expansive than normal. And one of the primary reasons is the water temperature. It's just the water in Utah Lake has warmed quicker, or at a faster rate, earlier, and it's going to remain there for the rest of the summer until the cool temperatures come in. But there's no chance for that water to cool off per se at night, but like you say, it holds heat too.
Yeah.
So, all right. So then it's the nighttime temperatures that are really showing up in warming versus daytime highs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how our temps have been looking. What about precip this spring and summer? Aside from snow, you know, what is that looking like?
April was pretty good for northern Utah. We did well, and then in May it dried out until we went into about less than 50% precip. And then June had around 25 to 30% precip. And now July is, you know, we had a little storm last night, maybe 10 to 15% of average. So it's been continually getting drier as it's getting hotter in May, June, and July. And that was a bonus for the flood scenario that we didn't have May that was 400% of normal like we saw 2 years ago and the year before that. If we would have had an average winter with temperature and that 400% precipitation in May, that really could have caused problems. But we didn't, and it got continually drier. The melt was orderly and had those four peaks. We filled the reservoirs. We didn't have flood damage, and that's what you want. That's what we're looking for.
Well, I think yesterday was the first rain event that we've had this month, at least in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Park Meadows.
Yeah, I think we had a little small one that went by. If you were going to measure, I think it probably was maybe a tenth, if that.
Is that measured at
on
the
Friday.
Library also?
Yeah.
And that data is online?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the ladies are doing it, and it's great. It was fabulous.
There are some men who work
this.
At the library, you know.
It was the ladies that I've dealt with.
Adrian and her staff.
Yeah, they're
good
great.
Job.
Yeah, good job. They get a
thank
gold
you.
Star.
Thank you, more importantly. Yeah.
Right?
Thanks for your contribution to citizen science.
Yeah.
That's what they
no,
do.
That's great.
No.
They were fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left,
and we
did want to talk about flash floods before we let you go, kind of about how they come about, how we can learn about them to kind of prevent some of these unfortunate scenarios. We've seen a couple of flash floods this summer so far.
Yeah. The monsoon has started. It's really not a true monsoon like you see in India, but what happens is the interior of Mexico aligns about 90 degrees with the sun's angle, and it starts to warm up a lot faster. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, it creates a low pressure over Mexico that pulls the air mass over the water in the Pacific Ocean is cold and wet, pulls that into Mexico, and then it surges northward into Arizona and Utah. When you have that air mass in a very moist kind of a grouping, you get the sun's energy, heats up the ground, and that air starts to rise. It lifts that parcel of air that has a lot of moisture, and then you get thunderstorm activity and flash floods. What we're noticing is that we're getting more intense flooding, more intense thunderstorms, which is leading to more flash floods, and they had a big fatality down in Phoenix from a flash flood, and that was really tragic, and it follows our 2015 event where we had 21 people die from a flash flood event. Really, it was one thunderstorm complex, but it affected three different groups of people, the ladies and the kids in Hilldale, the canyoneering people in Zion, and there was a guy who drove through the floodwaters. The storm lasted over 2 hours. Typically, these go for 20 minutes. You know, thunderstorms form
like
and then they decay.
Like last night's storm or something.
But this went over 2 hours. The thunderstorm that produced the flash flood down in Phoenix, the Weather Service had a warning out over an hour, hour and a half, and your phone should alarm inside that polygon that they draw, but the people didn't get the message, and they were swimming in a swimming hole that was formed over thousands of years of flash floods that go through there and erode the soil and erode the rock, and they were down in the slot, and the floodwaters kind of swept them all away, and that was really tragic. So we're seeing more of this. We had a storm north of Zion National Park last night that put down 2 to 3 inches of rain, according to the radar. And if that was over a little bit farther south in the Narrows or North Creek in the subway, we could have had some really bad problems with flash flooding. So it's kind of a hit and miss. If the storm is over an area that infiltrates and it isn't very steep, then you don't have a problem. And it's a nice rain event.
Right.
But if it's over a lot of the area of southern Utah's red sandstone, it's steep, there's a lack of vegetation, there's no infiltration, and it runs down like if you tipped a parking lot and fold it in half, just goes right down to the lower levels and creates this incredible energetic flood that rips through these places.
And you I believe that the area where these people drowned, it hadn't even rained there.
Yeah, it was upstream about 8 miles.
It was dry.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important note here. Pay attention to what's happening upstream when you're in
the
desert and canyon country.
And the Weather Service has an app that people can sign up for to get alerts?
Well, no. It's on your phone right now. If you have a smartphone, it will work.
Oh, it's automatic. So it's built
automatic.
In.
It'll just tell you.
Your phone comes with this. You have to disable it on your phone for it not to work.
Oh.
So theoretically, if the Weather Service issued a flash flood warning for the radio station right around us, all our phones would alarm.
Not mine.
It's a smartphone, but you're not flip phone. I don't know if you have a smartphone still, man.
But okay, so if you have a smartphone, what does it do? I mean,
it gives you an odd sounding tone, and a lot of people are like, "What is this?" And then you'll see the National Weather Service, like the crawlers on TV. The National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning. It displays on your screen.
Wow.
And at that point, you have to ask yourself, where am I? Am I in a low spot? I should get out of here.
Right.
I should really move to higher ground and heed what this warning is.
All right. Fantastic. Just so we're in monsoon season. So is it possible then that the rain that fell on my flowers on my back deck last night found its origin somewhere in the Pacific off the coast of Mexico?
Mm. Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it is cool.
Yeah.
I think those raindrops travel all that far to fall on my...
The residence time of a molecule of water out of the ocean, how it floats around the atmosphere, is about 7 days. That's why we can only forecast weather about 7 days. And then it precipitates out at some point.
What? That's the best thing you've said so far. 7 days
back
residence
to the day.
Time. Right? Now we know why. So seven days, even then you hesitate to go that far.
Yeah, and that's why it falls apart mathematically trying to model the atmosphere because of that reason.
So that raindrop might have found it might have risen out of the ocean 7 days ago.
Yeah.
Or less.
Roughly. Yeah. On average.
On average, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. Okay. Any other questions?
You know, I have one last burning question for Brian. In talking about these flash floods and, you know, the subway and the Narrows, I have to ask, would you hike in those places? Would you recreate in those places? Or do you avoid them? Do you think the forecasting is enough? Mm. You know?
I personally would go in those areas, no problem. But I would definitely check what the weather forecast is the day before. And I would look around before I went in to see if things are building in the morning hours. If you see thunderstorms building, I would really question whether we're going to go. And it's an assumption of risk. There's no right answer. And understand, the Weather Service doesn't get this right all the time. We do our best, but there's other things we can't quantify. There's variables that are out there that we don't really see with the radar. So understand you should have as much information as before you go. And we also put a flash flood product out that's the flash flood potential based on atmospheric conditions. Dry conditions, then go ahead and have a great time. But if it's you have a lot of moisture in the atmosphere, maybe not a good idea.
But if you wake up and the weather forecast says there's a 30% chance of thunderstorms in your area, is that a percentage that serves as a tipping point for you?
We try and stay away from the percentage of precipitation because it might just be light drizzly rain as opposed to intense thunderstorms, which produce flash floods. What I would do is do a search on the nationalweather.gov, and then you'll see a flash flood part on the bottom. Click that, and it'll give you a potential for that day. Dry, low, moderate, or high.
Okay.
And if it's dry, go. If it's low, you might want to be careful if you're in a slot can. Moderate, I'd stay out.
Okay.
And high, I would definitely stay out.
All right. So that's your cue.
That's what I would do.
That's what you follow.
Well, that's good to hear. Good. You know, I think a lot of us wonder about this as we head down to the desert and go to these places.
Yeah.
So.
And the monsoon season
is
here through July and in portions of August.
Through September.
Right. So be aware every day of the conditions.
Can I do one more thing?
Yes.
So my band Silverstrike is playing Molly Blooms tomorrow at 8 p.m.
I just learned that Brian plays the bass. It's an amazing band. Fun music.
Songs about weather and climbing?
No, it has nothing to do with that. This is a break from all that.
It's a National Weather Service branded band.
No, it is. Not at all. Stop it. But this is 8 o'clock tomorrow. Molly Blooms, if you're not doing anything, it's hump day. You know, come out, maybe have a few libations, dance a little bit, and fun time.
So yeah.
Thanks for allowing me to do the plug.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're band members
we're excited to hear
I had
to
do this, too. So.
You have a life outside of the Weather Service.
Yeah,
it's unthinkable,
really.
Brian.
I don't understand why. All right.
Right?
Brian, always great to have you on.
Yeah.
Great information. Thanks again. And we'll probably see you in a few months.
Yeah.
It's around September.
Yeah.
To give us a wrap up on
equinox.
That's right.
Back.
Post-eclipse. How about that?
Right.
Get your thoughts on that, too. All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, Michelle DeHaan and Clint McAfee from Park City Municipal join us to talk about the annual water quality report. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
G'day, it's Ian from Campos Coffee. Us Aussies really love a summer as much as we love supporting KPCW. We've got Nitro Cold Brew on tap, affogatos made with Wasatch Creamery ice cream, and Mamachari kombucha made with our Cascara coffee cherry. Located above the ice rink at Park City Mountain Resort next to the Adirondack chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
Enjoy the music of Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart, and more in a captivating chamber program of intriguing moods and textures featuring Stradivarius International Violin Competition winner Hannah Chang and the Utah Symphony. Ray Hotoda conducts Beethoven, Haydn, and more July 19th at St. Mary's Church. For all Utah Symphony summer shows, visit DeerValleyMusicFestival.org. Utah Symphony Utah Opera is a nonprofit organization and a sponsor of KPCW.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in studio is Michelle DeHaan. She's the Water Quality and Treatment Manager at Park City Municipal Corporation. And Clint McAfee, he's the Public Utilities Director at Park City. We want to thank both of you taking the time to come here and chat with us this morning about the 2017 Annual Water Quality Consumer Confidence Report. Nell is making the comments like she likes the fact that you add the word confidence in there.
Feel
is
good,
that,
right?
Is that
from
a requirement,
the start.
Or is that just you guys just feel so good about this
good
report?
Good morning. The Annual Consumer Confidence Report is called the CCR, actually. The EPA specifically does require annual reporting. And it's all about people understanding what their water quality is in drinking water. And
so EPA says every year, every municipality, every municipal water provider has to put together this report. And what elements have to go into the report?
It's a good question. So the Consumer Confidence Report specifically highlights things like where your water comes from. We have many different sources of drinking water within the city, seven mm-hmm. of them specifically. And it requires what contaminants are measured in your drinking water. We actually sample for over 100 contaminants in our drinking water sources. And of those contaminants that are actually detected, that's what's in the table that's in the report.
Mm-hmm.
We also need to talk about health information for the community so people understand where different contaminants could be coming from that are beyond the H2O in drinking water.
Right.
So minerals. In our community, we have some minute concentrations of metals from mining use of our mines locally.
Right.
And then
so
we
they're
also,
showing up in the raw, what's called the raw water
that's
coming
right.
into the, to,
yep.
to the plant, the headworks of the
yep.
plant.
And we have treatment for those
okay.
contaminants and specific reduction below the drinking water standards that are listed in the tables.
Okay.
So you mentioned you test for over 100 contaminants.
Yep.
That's a huge number. We only hear about a few of those.
That's right.
What are you testing for that doesn't show up in this report?
So a lot of the things that we don't detect are volatile organic compounds or synthetic compounds. So those are traditionally things that you find like water bottles often have things like phthalates in them. And so we don't detect things like that in our drinking water. Often manufacturing type contaminants that you would see in larger communities or where there might be some contamination from some type of manufacturing facility in the groundwater, something like that.
So being a little higher in the watershed probably works in our favor in that, that specific case.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And so do you test for any pesticides, herbicides, insecticides?
Yep. So those are some of the things that I mentioned relative to volatile or synthetic compounds. Those are herbicides, pesticides, volatile compounds.
Have you ever tested for caffeine?
We have not, but I know that the sewer district does. Mm-hmm.
They do.
They do.
And I've done some research when I was in Florida, and we found caffeine in traces, you know, parts per trillion
right.
or so.
Really yeah,
good.
There are.
But they showed up. They showed up in the groundwater.
Yep.
They showed up in stormwater pond samples. They showed up in tap water from a water fountain. So, you know, we talk about all these personal care products, and we've had Mike Lures on talking about how there's synthetic hormones that are showing up more and more in his wastewater process. But caffeine, we're such a caffeinated society now. It's getting into our water cycle. And so it wouldn't surprise me that at some point, perhaps, you may find caffeine, you know, traces of it in your head works.
Yeah, and because we are at the top of the watershed, we don't see those types of activities. And also we don't have what they call injection of other types of waters, whether it be river waters or secondary sources into our groundwater sources or into our river sources. In our particular case, we have a very pristine water source with, like, Smith Morehouse being the headwaters of one of our water treatment plants.
Is
over
it?
The Quinns Junction plant. Wow. So that's pretty much, you know, way up in the mountains, doesn't have much influence, if at all, in any industry.
Okay.
So let's talk about the sources. What are the variety of sources that you guys pull from?
Good question, because we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
We actually have
three
wells.
It's a complex system.
Yep. It is very complex. We have three different drinking water wells that we utilize. We treat water from the Rockport Reservoir at the headwaters of that, at the Quinns Junction Water Treatment Plant. That's an extremely high-tech, state-of-the-art treatment facility that is utilized with other communities that, you know, really are investing in high-tech type technologies for high-quality water. We also treat water from the Spiro Mine Tunnel. We have the Spiro Water Treatment Plant that removes arsenic and thallium from that water, and that was designed in the 90s, so that plant's been treating water for a long time for the city. And then we buy water from Jordanelle Special Services District as well.
And just building on Brian McInerney's analogy of a sponge, you know, we wrung it out four times, I think is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And like Michelle said, we are at the top of the watershed, so we don't have the advantage of upstream storage. So our mountains, you know, what we recreate on and bike and hike and ski and live and fertilize our lawns, underneath that is our sponge. So the mountains, you can think of them as a big sponge. And we maintain three tunnels, three historic mining drain tunnels, water drain tunnels, the Judge Spiro and the Ontario Drain Tunnel. And those essentially are under drains underneath that sponge, and just slowly collecting the water as the water drains down through the mountains. It lands in the tunnel and is conveyed to the portal where we use it. And I was just up in Empire Canyon this morning, and upstream of the Judge Tunnel, the drainage is dry. So, but for the tunnels, you know, there's not a lot of surface water running through Park City. All the water you see on McLeod Creek and running through the golf course, that's all coming out of Spiro Tunnel. Everything, most, I should say, of what's coming down Silver Creek is the Judge Tunnel. And they're pretty well positioned. They plan these for mining operations. But
right.
They're also great under drains for our mountains. So the Spiro starts at the golf course and heads up towards Jupiter Bowl. The Judge starts up in Empire Canyon and heads out towards Bonanza Flat. And the Ontario Drain discharges it at the Mayflower exit over on Highway 40 and kind of runs under Stein Erickson.
Right.
And they're all at different levels, and they, you know, it's just this big water collection system.
But like you say, these tunnels are artifacts of the mining operations.
Correct.
And we were mining for what? Different types of metals, you know, whether it's nickel or silver or so.
Correct.
So those are your challenges in meeting these compliances. Were you out of compliance with any of these heavy metals that you sampled for?
So we've been in compliance with drinking water standards for a number of years, including the report is specifically talking about the 2016 water quality. So
right.
We were in compliance with all drinking water standards
and
continue to be this year.
And so when and again, everybody in town was mailed this report.
Yep.
And it's a pretty it's pretty kind of a science-y report, but it lists the potential contaminant, we'll call it, say arsenic, and the levels detected, and then the compliance level, the MCLG or the MCL, maximum contaminant level, is 10 parts per million.
You got
and it looks like the testing you did, arsenic showed up, but at levels between 0.6 and 4.6 parts per million. So under that 10 part per billion, did I say million? Part per billion level that's allowed.
That's correct.
In drinking water. So that's good news. Okay. And so the list goes down with all the other contaminants or compounds that you evaluated for and show in this report, including trihalomethane, some of the more exotics that some water companies face because they may have a lot of organics in their raw water.
Correct. And trihalomethanes are primarily actually because of the fact that we do use chlorination for disinfectant in our water system. And we have very low levels of trihalomethanes and haloacetic acids, which are formed because of organic response within the
The chlorine
gets
together
process.
With some of the organic residuals it. And it forms these
particular compounds grow in time in our distribution system.
But you need to have the chlorine
low.
In there.
That's right.
Okay.
So moving on from that, there's also a radioactive contaminant that you've found. Tell us about that, where that comes from and what that means.
So gross alpha is the radioactive contaminant that was detected in the water, and it's at very low concentrations. The maximum concentration is at 4.4 picocuries per liter. So that's Madame Curie from our days of our chemistry classes when we learned about radiochemicals. And the drinking water limit is actually 15 micrograms per liter compared to the 4.4 that was detected. And these are basically a decay of natural formed contaminants in the soils. So that's very natural compound.
Okay.
It's found no different than in our particular waters where you'd have a very, very, very low concentration of something like nitrate in our water. So that type of thing that could exist. But it's just super low concentrations, extremely natural in our environment.
No need to panic.
No need to panic.
Right. And we're speaking with Michelle DeHaan and Clint McAfee, both with Park City Municipal. We're talking about the annual water quality report that everybody received and every town resident received in their mail, and we're trying to go through it and explain. We've got a bunch more questions. We've got about 10 minutes or so.
We're going to have to move fast.
Well, here's the big one. Got to get to this one. Lead.
Yeah.
You tested for lead. Is there lead in our water?
So the low levels of lead that we have in our water are well below any drinking water standard, and we're very different than places like Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to really call that out because the big difference in Park City is that we don't have lead service lines or any lead pipes in our water system.
Right.
And Flint, Michigan has lead service lines. And that's where the biggest challenge came in Flint. The concentrations that we have in our water tested at 20 households, so we want to thank our residents for supporting us in that, were at less than 2 parts per billion, while the standard is 15 parts per billion.
Right.
And so the concentrations of lead we have are very low from things like lead solder that were used in the history of plumbing within households, and that's where the primary risk is. And then secondarily, in very minute concentrations from the mine tunnels and use of them in our distribution system. And again, down in the 2 part per billion range where the standard's 15.
Again, even in places like Flint, the lead wasn't in their raw water.
That's
correct. It was in the water that was exposed to the lead piping after the treatment plant. So the water came out of the treatment plant fine. It tested fine.
Yeah.
But as it was through the distribution system, it was going through these old lead-based piping, and that's where it was picking up. That's where the lead was kind of dissolving into the water and ending up in their tap water. But again, like you said, Michelle, we don't have lead pipe in this town. Lead solder, in perhaps here or there,
correct.
But no lead piping. So our lead levels are fine. Okay.
Right. And one of the things that was important this year is that we collaborated with Summit County and with the Park City School District, and it was great that they stepped up and did voluntary monitoring for lead in schools. And that's been a really important program as well. And they, again, were in the same range as we were in our drinking water at the schools at like 2 parts per billion as the highest concentration.
Okay.
So
good.
That's been an important thing to talk about this year, too.
Thank you.
So everything that we've heard about so far sounds really good. That's great news. Are there any concerns that you guys have your eyes on as the managers of this? Is there anything you're keeping a close watch on or concerned about this year or future years?
Yeah, I would say one of our biggest challenges right now is treatment of the mine tunnels for stream water discharge and the cost to do so. So currently we're under order from the Utah Division of Water Quality to comply with water quality standards in the discharges of Judge and Spiro Tunnel. Over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, we've been talking with the state, and over the last couple of years, we've been identifying the technology and infrastructure we need to treat the water down to stream water standards. And we've identified the technology and a location, but the big concern is the cost to comply with these standards. The cost range, they're high. It puts us in, as a community, in a position where the water rates are just extremely unaffordable. And the way that unaffordable is defined in the EPA's eyes is if the cost of wet utilities as a percentage of the area's modified adjusted gross income is more than 2%, then it's considered unaffordable. The state of Utah uses 1.4%, and we're well above that currently.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to build all the infrastructure that we've identified, we'd be well above that. We're talking in the 4% range.
Wow.
So more than double what's considered affordable, and up to, you know, almost three times what the state considers unaffordable. The good news is we're talking with the state and they understand this, and they're willing to work with us. We had a really long workshop with them yesterday, a productive meeting. There's kind of some new staff down, and the previous staff was great too, but we're really educating the new staff down at DWQ, Division of Water Quality. And they are very open and understanding. And they also understand that drinking water is number one. And that, you know, the cost to rebuild the Spiro Water Treatment Plant, has to be factored into all these costs. So that's one of the bigger things that keeps us up at night, I guess.
Okay.
And so the primary contaminants you're thinking, you need to take out?
Yeah, they're pretty similar for, and I'll let Michelle answer this.
Yeah, they primarily include the same contaminants that we've been dealing with at the Spiro plant, plus a few more that we deal with in Judge Tunnel Water. And so we're primarily looking at arsenic, thallium, antimony is one of the ones we've talked about in the past here in the community, where we had a variance for that for Judge in past years. And now we're working on the design of treatment facilities for drinking water primarily. And it's interesting to note that the stream standards in many cases are much more stringent than the drinking water standards. And that's the case for things like thallium specifically. So we're looking at reduction of arsenic, lead, thallium, iron and manganese, and antimony. Those are the primary drivers for the stream standards and at higher levels for drinking water.
Okay. Got it. Got a few more minutes. I got a couple more questions. Let me throw one in here.
Go for it.
Summertime water demand. Even though our population, there's more people in town here during the winter than, say, relative to being the summer. Our water demand is higher during the summer. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Why? In 30 or 45
outdoor
seconds.
Outdoor irrigation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Outdoor, tick them too.
What percentage do you guys think of daily water demand goes to watering grass?
70%.
70% of the day. And how much is that? What's the daily water demand?
So what we treat and put in our pipes and serve through meters is about 9 million gallons a day on a peak day.
So roughly 70% of 9 million.
Plus,
6 million gallons.
Yeah.
And so then, about 6 million gallons going to...
And then another two on the municipal golf course and the country club.
Okay.
So 8 million.
Unbelievable. People, you're watering your lawns first with drinking water, okay? You want to know why your bills are so high? You pay so much for it? Because you're watering your lawns. You shouldn't even be growing grass in this town. because of the demand it takes, 1 to 1.5 inches of water a week to grow grass. It's nuts. But that's, you know, that's another show, another time for another show. But that's incredible how much water goes to just watering our lawns in this town. Danny,
To follow up on that, you know, has there ever been discussion of like a secondary system, right? Like a that wouldn't be treated to drinking water level standards?
Good question. Reclaimed water.
Yeah.
Real quick. Sorry.
So those are two different things.
Will the state allow reclaimed water?
So we haven't looked into that because the treatment plants are so far away from Park City.
I thought they might have a set policy.
And then you run into some water right issues, and I believe they are irrigating on some golf courses.
Okay,
it
so
requires
they,
a certain amount of additional
it's
treatment.
Possible.
It's possible. The challenge we run into is, you know, we've already got pipes in the ground, and in order to convert, like, your front yard into a raw water source, we'd have to dig up all the streets in town. It's just cost prohibitive.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the same topic comes up when, you know, part of our snowmaking delivery is from our drinking water system. But it's actually less energy intensive from, you know, a holistic standpoint than building a separate system to serve snowmaking with raw water.
Okay.
But we are strategically looking at converting some of the bigger areas. Like we've like the North 40, a bunch of the school fields are now irrigated off the raw water line coming into town from Rockport.
Oh, okay.
And that's, we look at that as less treatment we have to build.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, kind of a less energy intensive, although that is the case too. It's a little bit less energy intensive just to deliver raw water because the pipe's already there.
Yeah, all already right. in place. So.
2 minutes. We're just going to go right up to NPR.
That's
now.
Right.
All right. 2 minutes. Because I really want to get your thoughts on this. You had to do all this testing, annual testing, to meet EPA standards and requirements and compliance and regulations. Bottled water. They are under – I know you need more than 2 minutes, Michelle, but just try to summarize. Bottled water, the level of testing that's typically required for bottled water. Is it the same as what you go through?
So as we talk about, actually, it's a requirement within the annual consumer confidence report. Bottled water is actually regulated by FDA.
Food and Drug Administration.
Food and Drug
Administration. Do they require bottled water companies to test for pesticides and insecticides and lead and all that?
Very occasionally, but not nearly as stringent as we do for public drinking water.
Thank you. All right. That's critical. Because people go buy their bottled water and it's got fancy packaging and it's clear and it looks yummy and it's, but you don't know what the sources are.
That's exactly
technically right.
They don't even have to report as sources. They could
they don't
be a
have
well
to have a
parking
consumer
lot.
Confidence report like this.
Exactly.
By any means.
So please don't think that your bottled water its water quality is better than Park City's. Park City's tap water is fantastic. I drink it all the time. Thank you very much, and all of us should. We should drink it instead of putting on our lawns. Now, last word. I'm fired
I'm on
up
board.
About-
Ditto. Well, that was going to be my last question, too, I think.
Right.
The bottled water
minute.
Versus tap water. And that also goes for the big 5-gallon water dispensers, because that's also FDA.
That's correct.
So lower standards. Something to think about as you're choosing your water source.
Thank you for joining. Next time you guys come on, we'll give you more time.
Thanks for having us today.
Michelle DeHaan, Clint McAfee with Park City Municipal and the annual water quality report. It's available online. We got to hustle. I got to do one underwriter. We'll be right back.
Do it.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org. Additional funding for programs.